at 4, and LaSalle visits Duquesne at 7 tonight. The women's game, LaSalle hosts St. Bonaventure at 1, and St. Joe's hosts Duquesne at 2 today. Listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and those of you who know me personally will be shocked, by our choice of the question of the week. We're actually going to tell people how to grow Brussels sprouts and how to get them especially sweet tasting. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Elle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elle. How are you?
Well, it's rather cold here, but we're managing to stay warm.
Okay, and where is here?
It's Beaver Island, Michigan, which is an island that's in the middle of northern Lake Michigan.
As soon as you said Beaver Island in Michigan, I started shivering.
Yeah.
What can we do for Elle out in the middle of Lake Michigan?
Well, I have grown asparagus for years now in various places. We're now in a relatively new house. We have a raised bed that is 3 feet wide by about 60 feet long.
Oh, wow. That's a real railroad car.
Yeah. So we planted asparagus all along the one edge all along.
Oh, that sounds dangerous.
Well, we also tried growing other things in that bed along with asparagus. And always in the past, in the fall when the fronds are way up,
right,
they've been dark green.
Mm-hmm.
This year, they're yellow. What are we doing? What do we need to do?
Well, I'm kind of shocked that you didn't give the asparagus a dedicated area.
I know. We have a very small lot, and we just don't have a lot of room.
Well, but you have 60 feet of linear space.
Yes, and we put in 60 feet of asparagus.
Right, but you did it like in one row, but
yes.
Asparagus doesn't stay in a row, as you've probably learned.
Uh-huh.
The spears come up in different areas, so were we to use the most valuable organic tool on this show, which is a time machine,
mm-hmm.
and go back and you call me before you planted it, I would have told you to take one end of that 60-foot-long thing and maybe devote 10 feet of it to asparagus crowns, using up the whole 3-foot length. Asparagus does not like competition. Now, because it's only 3 feet wide and you say it's a raised bed, you're clearly not walking in it, right?
No. Now, we have dedicated one end of it to strawberries, and
okay.
We don't have asparagus there. But can we put more than one row in the 3 foot wide?
To tell you the truth, I do not grow asparagus personally. I have a limited amount of space, and I have written about it, and I know people who grow it, and I have to be honest and say that off the top of my head, I don't remember the exact suggested spacing when the crowns are first put into the ground. But I would imagine, if I remember correctly, and my wife is now laughing insanely, you could typically get 2 crowns
okay.
in a 3 foot wide area. But I would have also staggered them. I would have planted them like the 5 of diamonds or something,
mm-hmm.
So that they're using up their space. And again, where you plant the crowns, you could just plant a row of crowns down the center almost, and eventually that area that you've dedicated would have had spears come up in every little corner.
Okay.
But that's what I would have done, is I would have blocked off one side and keep the asparagus there. Because, asparagus is also a heavy feeder, which the yellowing to me is an indication of. How are you feeding it what it wants, which is a lot of nitrogen, without interfering with what I presume are tomatoes and cucumbers and other stuff in the bed.
Well, we're not. We're putting an organic fertilizer in there, but it's on everything.
Yeah. See, asparagus is so different. What I would suggest when you can, I might try to dig up some crowns and replant a dedicated area. Like I'm saying, take that first 10 feet at the other edge of where the strawberries are dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And just make that an asparagus patch. And then maybe build some sort of barrier so that the asparagus stays in that 10-foot area and just keeps coming up. And an asparagus doesn't mind being confined like that, although the spears might eventually start showing up outside that area. But then you could really give that the kind of well-composted horse manure that asparagus thrives on without reducing the fruiting of your other crops. But it sounds to me like it just needs a feeding. Asparagus really likes a lot of nitrogen, likes a really rich natural feeding. And that's very difficult to do, because if you give it enough to make the asparagus happy, you're going to limit the fruiting on your summer crops.
All right.
All right. Well, good luck. I hope you can move those crowns successfully.
Oh, thank you, Mike. And I really enjoy your show.
Thank you very much. You take care.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I've got a problem. I live in Dover, Delaware.
Okay.
Not too far from Philly.
Okay. I know Dover.
We planted a hawthorn tree about 6 years ago. We wanted to see the red berries during the winter. Well, the hawthorn tree is growing nicely. It's about 12 feet tall and about 8 feet wide, but it doesn't have any red berries.
And you do have other hawthorns in the area, so pollination isn't an issue.
We're west of the city of Dover,
mm-hmm.
and the other hawthorns I'm seeing are in the city of Dover.
Right.
So, you know, I have not seen anything that said we're dealing with a male-female like we are with hollies.
Do you see flowers?
Well, we see a fair attempt at flowering,
okay.
but they're not that obvious.
Now, does it get a lot of sun?
It has early morning and late afternoon sun. There is an oak tree on the neighboring property.
Do you feed it or mulch it?
Well, when we planted it, it went in with about one-third what they call topsoil down here, one-third rotted leaf mulch, and one-third our compost. Then we have checked the pH, and it's 6.3. It is fertilized, and it is mulched.
Oh, okay. What are you fertilizing it with?
Oh, he says he put some lime on it.
Okay, so lime is not fertilizer. Lime would bring that pH up a little bit to neutral. But they do need a lot of sun to flower. Other than that, these are pretty rugged trees. These are actually good urban trees. They can take drought. It's not planted in an area that doesn't drain well, is it?
No, in fact, it is on a little slight slope, and we have a raised bed, and it's part of the raised bed.
You may be treating this thing much too nicely. Hawthorns are a tree that almost God designed to plant it and forget it. It's a great tree for urban areas. Again, it can take smog, it can take drought. It does not like to be fed. It does not like to be coddled. After it's established, it does not like to be artificially watered. And did you say that you had mulched it?
There has been mulch, but basically around the base there is periwinkle.
Oh, that's not, and going right up to the trunk of the tree, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you see, in nature, these trees live alone. They like that area at the base of their trunk exposed. the first reason plants don't bloom as much as people would like is shade. This is a full sun tree to get the best berries. What I'd like you to do is, now that, you know, because we're right in the middle of winter pruning time, if there is a limb here or there that could come off of another tree that would get this poor puppy some sunlight, that might be nice. Do not feed it anything again. Do not let your husband lime it. If I were you, I would rip out the periwinkle, quite honestly.
Okay.
And then in the fall, after you've done nothing to take care of it, just sprinkle 1 cup of rock phosphate at the base of the tree. In the fall, cover that with some soil, but otherwise, don't baby it, don't be nice to it, and at least pull back the periwinkle. Let the base of the tree get some air.
Okay, well, I'll try it, and when we get some red berries, I'll call you back and let you know.
Very good, very good. Good luck, Carol.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and once again warn all of our listeners in and around the Akron area that I am coming your way. It's getting close now. I'm going to appear at the Akron Home and Flower Show on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. And I urge you to come out and see me, if only for the fact that my favorite act, the Duct Tape Guys, will be appearing with me. You've never seen anything like them. But don't you go marking your calendars for the 25th and 26th just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow Brussels sprouts that are sweet as candy. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com. You're listening to WHYY. It's 1119, 44 degrees now in Center City.
Widener supports WHYY. At Widener University, graduate courses are taught with real-life leadership experiences in a stimulating educational environment. In addition to their academic programs, Widener is committed to delivering the means for professional advancement and personal growth students seek in a graduate program, while accommodating work schedules through a variety of graduate degrees, including nursing, education, higher education, and more. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works.
Sign up now for classes at WHYY's Dorrance H. Hamilton Public Media Commons. Starting February 2nd, learn the art of audio storytelling. For more information, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And yes, I have been guilty of maligning Brussels sprouts on the past and have made repeated threats that will never teach you how to grow a vegetable that requires an equal amount of butter to be edible. But we're going to break that vow for a really nice listener who wants to grow great Brussels sprouts. And in researching how to do that, we learned a lot about these cute little cabbages. We'll share that knowledge with you after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Grace, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Grace. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing very well. Thank you. Where is Grace Fine?
We're in Ewing Township, which is just north of Trenton, New Jersey.
Ah, Trenton makes, the world takes.
Yes, it does.
All right. What can we do for Grace in Ewing Township?
Well, I had a question about vinegar. I love to use vinegar on the weeds, by the curb, in the street gutters. I also use it as far as in between the slabs of concrete on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is how does that affect the bugs, especially the beneficial bugs like the redworms and other things that are in the ground? Does it make it too acidic for them?
Well, now, what strength vinegar are you using?
The 5%.
So you're not even going for what's called horticultural vinegar, vinegar with a higher acidity rating than supermarket vinegar. You're just using the regular 5%.
Yeah, that seems to work pretty well for me.
And do you put it in a spray bottle and spray the weeds, or do you saturate the area?
I like to saturate the area.
In studies of soil solarization, which is a similar situation, that's where you mow the vegetation down and cover the soil with plastic and bake it for the season.
Mm-hmm.
There is some loss of soil life in the immediate sense while it's baking. But what scientists were shocked to find is that when the solarization was over and the ground was cultivated again, the soil life not only returned, but was healthier and in greater numbers than before the process.
Oh.
So there seems to be something about getting rid of weeds that may be even some weeds that may be beneficial for soil life. But I'll tell you what to do. You're very thoughtful. The only thing that you are possibly going to injure in a situation like this down in the soil is, as you point out, earthworms, not redworms. Redworms are composting worms. They're a different kind of species. They don't exist naturally outside the way earthworms do.
Oh, okay.
One way to avoid ever injuring a worm is to wait until the soil is dry. Earthworms will not stay in soil that is dry. They have the ability and they enjoy going down as deep as 6 feet to follow the moisture. They want to be in the moistest part of soil. So you wait until the soil's been nice and dry for a while, and then I would suggest what you do is you wait for a hot and sunny day, and you put this 5% vinegar in a spray bottle, and you go out and you saturate just the weed itself. Just soak it down at high noon on a hot and sunny day when the soil underneath it is dry. I think you'll get a lot more bang for your buck from the vinegar. You'll totally desiccate the plants, and there's no chance of you harming anything in the soil.
Oh, okay, great.
But remember, with any herbicide, chemical or organic, it's always going to work best on a drought-stressed plant.
Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Grace. Thank you for caring about your worms. You're a good person.
I enjoy listening to your show.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, Mike, hi. I love your show. You've given me so many tips. I'm feeling fine in Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. What section of Philadelphia?
Oh, East Mount Airy.
A beautiful area.
Oh, yes, it is. Well, I don't have a problem. I have more of a mystery.
Right.
That I think you may be able to solve. We have a beautiful Alberta spruce in the backyard.
Right.
It was about 30 years old, maybe 30 feet high. But growing out of it are branches of a blue spruce. I've showed it to lots of neighbors and the Fairmount Park Commission, and no one can tell me how a blue spruce is growing out of an Alberta spruce. There is one branch coming up from below, but now another branch is coming up, and we haven't grafted it. I thought grafting was so difficult to do, so I just don't know how this mystery is happening.
Well, now you have a really well-established Alberta spruce, which is
beautiful.
A beautiful tree. I actually bought a live one this year that I'm going to cultivate as a future Christmas tree. I really like the look. And interestingly enough, it's replacing a blue spruce I had to cut down, so I know how different they look. Now, did you plant the Alberta spruce?
My parents planted it about 30 years ago.
Where do you see branches that are bluey sprucey?
Well, there's one branch about 18 inches above the roots, and that's growing up. I mean, that's about like 6 feet tall. And then another branch started coming out about 6 feet out on a side branch.
it's not a multiple trunk, right? None of the blue spruce material is coming out of the ground.
No.
And the blue spruce sports that are coming out, are they coming out of the trunk, or are they coming out of branches, or are they...
Well, one of the branches is coming out of the trunk, and another one is coming out of the branches.
Okay. There's two things that could be going on here. One is, this is just some old genetic material that was in the DNA of your Alberta spruce that's been dormant, that is now kind of asserting itself. Ooh. You know, going backwards in time... All of these plants in this genus were like one plant.
Mm.
And over time, they developed their distinguishing characteristics. Every once in a while, you will see an old remnant piece of DNA kind of establishing itself. There's also two other things that can sometimes happen.
Well, someone told me that they thought it was birds. Birds came over and pecked into the bark and put seeds into it.
Or squirrels.
Squirrels. Oh, I have a lot of squirrels. Oh.
Squirrels can carry a lot of genetic material around with them. Pine cones would be more birdish, where squirrels tend to go for nuts, but squirrels make nests in these kinds of trees. And when they make the nest, they build it out of a lot of organic matter, a lot of sticks, and a lot of leaves. And, of course, over the summer, that nest tends to compost. So if there's a blue spruce pine cone in there, it would not be at all unusual for the spruce to sprout and root into the kind of mother tree. And then finally, there's a type of parasitism that occurs where the material will simply be blown in by the wind, and the rogue seed will kind of plant itself in the tree. So there'd be nothing wrong with you having the blue spruce parts removed.
Oh, no, I love it. I love it. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And, you know, and I thought the only way you could get this is through crafting. And I'm so shocked that it's just doing it on its own.
If you were to get up on a ladder or whatever and really carefully examine the area where one of these blue spruce shoots comes out, and you were to really get in there and move stuff around and feel around the joint where the one tree becomes the other tree, you should be able to tell if this is just a genetic sport. That is, if it's just the Alberta spruce sending out a rogue branch from some dimly remembered relative, or you will be able to see the scarring and the signs that another tree has actually rooted, like generally in the crotch of a branch where dirt and water can take hold. But as long as you like it...
I love it.
Just tell people it's a double. It's very rare.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you so much. I love your show. You've given me so many tips over all the years. Take good care of yourself. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, my name is Rick. I have a farm just outside of Annapolis, and I have an incredible problem with weeds, invasive weeds, and I was wondering how to control them on a large scale organically.
And how big is the farm? How many acres are you actually working?
85 acres, but fortunately not the entire property is covered with weeds, but specifically there in the woods I have English ivy, literally taking over trees. My neighbor's is actually worse and is spreading to remote sections of the farm. I guess birds are dropping leaves or seeds or something. Chrysanthemum weed, which I think is Artemisia something.
Are we talking about controlling the weeds in areas that you're using as farmland, or are you talking about weeds in the adjacent woods?
I'm talking about both. The chrysanthemum weed is in the fields. The ivy tends to be mostly in the woods, and it's beginning to take over. Again, the neighbors more so than mine, but it's beginning to take over sections of their woods. Yeah.
There's no quick answer. There's no good answer. I will tell you that in organic farming, weed control tends to be the biggest issue, the most time-consuming, the most resource-consuming. Now, are you a member of NOFA, you know, the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, or are you involved with any other kind of organized organic farming associations who can help you?
I have read materials from different organizations, but I'm not involved. Basically, the farm is, I have some nursery stock that I use in my business. There's a lot of woodland that is for future timber. The fields are basically planted in warm season grasses for wildlife conservation and some hunting. But nonetheless, I still would like to eradicate the chrysanthemum weed from the fields and the ivy from the woods. And I would prefer to do it organically as much as possible.
There's really no option there. Ivy is one of these plants that any kind of herbicide is helpless against because it's so waxy. It just rolls right off of it. You would have to kill the woods. You'd have to, like, pour liquid plutonium into the ground to kill the ivy systemically, and you'd be doing much more destruction than the ivy alone would. My best suggestion would be you need to create some sort of demarcation between the woods and your growing areas to prevent the constant march forward of the weeds. You need to dig a trench. You need to install rhizome barrier. And then after that, I mean, you can solarize your fields. It sounds like you're in a good situation where you can solarize the chrysanthemum weeds out of your fields in one good summer. And I will tell you, if you go to our website, if you go to You Bet Your Garden and you click on Garden Answers A to Z, go under S, the letter S, there is a tutorial on solarization. Now, I think I actually got most of my information from various organic farming organizations, and I would urge you to become more active with NOFA or the organic farmers in your area, as other farmers have battled these weeds and may have some good ideas.
Okay.
In the woods, with ivy, the only thing I know that works is physical removal, and that's I know it sounds impossible, but I have had many emails that have reassured me that this actually works. People who tried it, and they said this, after the first year, they thought they were wasting their time, but by the third year, they were done. And that is to constantly sever the vine where it's coming out of the ground. Don't worry about the stuff that's growing up the trees. Don't worry about the stuff that's trailing. Constantly sever the vine where it's coming out of the ground. At the end of the summer, you're going to see a ton of dead ivy around. You can pull it down out of the trees to free up the canopies, to try to get some air at the trunks. The second year, do the same thing, and you will be able to beat it back. But, you know, you can't let something as almost invulnerable as English ivy grow for years and years and expect to get it under control in a month or two.
Sure.
I mean, it's resistant to flame weeding. It's resistant to vinegar. It's resistant to any spray on herbicide. Once you get to the second or third year of severing the vine, the new growth, the root system is going to be exhausted. You will see it being pushed back. And all the areas that you've worked on, after 2 or 3 years, there will not be any regrowth left. And it should not be a ton of hard work, and you won't have to really buy anything. You just have to be persistent. You just have to make sure, like, 1 week every year, or, you know, a couple of days every month, you go into the woods, you sever this growth. you will see the second year that already it's now turning the tide.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you for taking my call.
Well, good luck to you, sir. You have a very tough enemy, and we wish you well.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who doesn't have land of their own, but who still wants to eat fresh, local, and organic, that now is the time to seek out and join your local CSA. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, but what it really means is it's a local form in which you buy a subscription for the season. You buy a share of the farm, and all throughout the spring and summer and fall, you get a share of the produce produced by that farm. It's fresh, it's local, it's almost always organic. CSAs are one of the best ways to eat local, fresh, organic food for those who can't grow your own. But don't you go looking for the lists of local CSAs at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to make your Brussels sprouts sweet and lots of your sweet phone calls. I'm Sweet Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Sweet Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38, 45 degrees on Independence Mall.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture will hold their 21st annual Farming for the Future conference this coming Wednesday through Saturday in State College, PA. The Longwood Graduate Program will bring zoos and public gardens together for their annual symposium on Friday, March 2nd at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, PA. I'll open my speaking season with appearances at noon and 2 at the Grounds for Sculpture Park in Hamilton, New Jersey on Sunday, February 5th. Then I'll appear at the Home Show in Annapolis on Saturday, the 18th, and give a tomato growing talk at Green Spring Gardens in Alexandria, Virginia on Sunday, the 19th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Fresh Air Weekend comes your way at 1 today on WHYY. TV writer David Milch will join us. He's a creator of the new HBO series Luck, which goes inside the world of horse racing, focusing on characters like trainers, jockeys, owners, and, of course, gamblers. Milch also created the HBO series Deadwood. Join us at 1 today here on WHYY. The forecast, mostly sunny with a high of about 48. Seasonal high for this time of year is 41. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low 30. And Sunday, sunshine and a bit cooler, the high 46. Right now, it's 45 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A shocking one for me, especially for those who know how I personally feel about Brussels sprouts. But I will put my personal peccadilloes aside and help a listener who wants to grow those cute little cabbages. We'll tell you how to grow ones that look like they belong in the supermarket, big, tightly wrapped heads, and we'll also teach you the trick that makes those cabbages as sweet as possible. Right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm doing good, Susan. How are you?
Fine.
And where is Susan Fine?
South Jersey in a little town called Greenwich.
So what can we do for Susan from Greenwich?
Well, in any case, you had a caller that was contemplating taking down one, if not both, of his beautiful ginkgo trees. And it struck a chord with me because we have six beautiful ginkgo trees that surround the only Tebring monument, or the only monument in the state of New Jersey that commemorates the Revolutionary War. Those trees are planted around that monument. And in any case, I've lived here for 50, 8 years, and those trees are absolutely beautiful. The leaves are like a heavy, waxy, fan-shaped leaf. And when they fall, the entire ground is the most beautiful shade of yellow that you have ever seen. And the fruit is just it's a very short time. So I was just hoping that that fellow might get some education or more education about how valuable those trees are before he decides to cut one down.
Well, you know, if you did hear that phone call, we did talk about how these are remarkable trees. The leaf of the ginkgo is processed into a nutritional supplement that many people feel can help prevent dementia or at least ease the symptoms. Susan, you and your fellow townspeople have to admit that when that fruit drops, the place stinks like an uncleaned kennel.
Actually, there's not that much of a stink on the fruit, unless, of course, you actually step on it. It dries rather quickly. I mean, most of the children, I mean, I grew up here. My three children grew up here with the ginkgos, you know, and when the fruit would fall, it was a sort of a game about walking around it. And then, of course, my grandchildren like to make ginkgo soup because it is pink. And the actual seed inside dries a very beautiful, because the fruit falls away fairly quickly, and it leaves a beautiful white, looks like a puffed-up pumpkin seed. And I don't know who uses it. I don't know if the mice use it, the squirrels, but there's probably a story on the seeds.
Well, and you're not alone, Suze. I mean, this is a favorite tree of a lot of people. One of the reasons it's been around so long is it's a very hardy tree. So they tend to be very tough trees, and they were planted in large numbers as street trees in cities. And that's where the problems began. When they would be a street tree in the city, they would drop their fruits, people would step on the fruits, and then the whole block would smell like doggy doo for like the month of September or October, or whenever the fruits drop down. But your township apparently loves these trees so much that they ignore the smell.
Apparently. And it really isn't like, once when it dries, it wouldn't be like doggy doo at all, or any other real type of garbage. It's a strong smell when it's freshly dropped and squashed, of course, but it dissipates rather quickly. And but actually, the roots have lifted up the concrete slabs around that monument, and that's traditional too, you know, the bumping up and down while you're on a bicycle, or if you're smart enough to be in a stroller, that's a real ride to go around there with all the bumps. But they're quite gorgeous. These trees, just the bark alone is absolutely beautiful, and the shape of the branches.
Oh, they are, and the shape of the leaf is hugely distinctive. And you are not alone. A lot of the early settlers, a lot of the framers, Washington and Jefferson, really valued their trees. And just to make sure you understand, Susan, we're not sending anybody out to cut down your trees. This is just a guy who...
who doesn't know how valuable his trees are.
And if he's listening, maybe you'll have given him a second thought.
I hope so.
All right. It's always good to have somebody come on and defend a tree. We can only hope the man will do the right thing.
Good enough.
All right. You take care, Suze. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Neil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, and I have a rose bush problem.
Okay. Where is Neil fine?
Well, I live on a boat, and I travel from New Hampshire to Florida, in Florida in the winter, of course, and I must have my rose bush stay on the boat with me.
Huh. And are you on the water in Florida right now?
Yes, I am.
And may I ask where?
In Vero Beach.
Okay, very good. How big is your boat?
32 feet. Okay. It's a motor sailor catamaran.
Oh, okay. Now, does this rose bush exist, or is this a hopeful rose bush?
Well, the story is, last year I bought a knockout rosebush.
Okay.
Put it on the boat, and it was doing beautiful. It would flower probably 15, 20 blossoms and so forth until I got to Oriental, North Carolina. And I stayed there for the summer. And in August, it bloomed real nice and then died completely.
Huh. What kind of a container was it in?
It was in a plastic pot with holes in the bottom.
Good.
And I sat that on pebbles inside a pail. It had ample sun. And I would water it frequently, probably once a week, something like that.
Why was it in a bucket with pebbles in the bottom?
The pebbles would allow the water to drain out of the plastic container if it rained.
And fill up the bucket.
And get all over the boat.
And fill up the bucket where it would rot the roots of the rose.
I wouldn't let it get that high. I had the pebbles probably an inch and a half up.
I would prefer that if we try this again, you get a conventional dish-type structure to put underneath the pot. And every time it rains or that saucer gets filled up with water, that you simply empty it out. And I'm not saying that's what went wrong, but I don't like the bucket. What did you feed it?
There's a Busy Bee flower shop down here, and they gave me some time-release pellets.
Okay.
And I fed it once every 3 months.
Okay. Chemical fertilizer really builds up harshly in pots. One of the advantages of growing in ground is that stuff washes out instead of building up salts in the pot. Your next rose, maybe make the pot a little bigger. I'm just guessing. Roses develop a very large and complex root structure, so they would like the biggest pot that you're willing to give them. And the pot should be filled with 3/4 of a soil-free mix and 1/4 compost. And then you need to find a garden center somewhere along your pirate travels that has some nice natural organic plant foods. And you want a nice natural organic plant food for flowering plants. It doesn't sound like you are feeding too often, which is good because roses are not heavy feeders. And if you're going to use a granular fertilizer, which probably makes more sense on a boat than a liquid one, which may have a scent to it, you always want to cover that with a little bit of soil or compost after you apply it to the top of the plant. I don't know why your old one died. I will tell you that the biggest problem you face is probably a plant on a boat like yours is always going to risk getting too much sun. A rose loves morning sun. But after like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, especially as we get into the high point of summer, give it some shade after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Obviously, with a container like this, you really do need to keep an eye on the watering. Because again, on a boat, you're experiencing the most wind possible. And wind does desiccate plants. It literally wicks the moisture right out of them. But if you give it some afternoon shade, protect it from high winds, switch to a more natural fertilizer and container mixture, I see no reason that this should not work. And I don't want you to get discouraged because you tried something once for the first year. And it sounds like you had at least 2 runs of blooms on your rose.
Oh, I probably had 7 or 8.
Yeah, so you got your money's worth.
Oh, yeah. I was also worried about salt buildup from the air.
In the morning, as the sun comes up, you can mist the plant. You can spray it down with cool, plain water. And that'll get any salt off of it. The salt will go into the pot. You'll give the pot a watering. The salt will come out the bottom. But that's right. I wasn't really thinking about the salt. And you added salt to the potting mix when you use that chemical fertilizer. So,
yeah,
let's add a misting every couple of mornings to freshen up those leaves. And I think we got a good plan here. All right, Neil, you take care. You boat safely.
Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for your advice.
No, you're more than welcome, Neil. Stay safe on the water. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, brushing up on Brussels sprouts. Our question comes from Janice in Hannibal, Missouri, who writes, I've been trying to grow Brussels sprouts the past 2 years. I start from seed, and each year the plants do well. They get big and healthy and strong, but the sprouts are loose-leafed and very small. I garden in sunny raised beds. I feed the plants with my own compost and a fish and seaweed fertilizer. Should I even bother trying again? Thanks for your help. I don't know how I'd make it without your show. Well, darn, Janice, your nice compliment at the end there trumps my natural impulse to say that we don't help people grow foods that require an equal amount of melted butter to induce human consumption. And we do need new topics for the A to Z archive, so I guess it's off to Brussels we shall sprout. Just don't expect to be hearing any lima bean tips anytime soon. All right, to get started, the variety Prince Marvel shows up repeatedly as a Brussels sprout of choice for having tightly wrapped sprouts. It was even named a best variety for the Zone 5 region by a pair of organic gardening magazine testers who garden just an hour west of you in Macon, Missouri. Now, there's also a number of newer varieties available with Marvel in their name. They should be just as good, if not better. The name Long Island Improved also shows up on a lot of BS lovers' lists, and Andrea Ray Chandler of Kansas, who also tested crops in Zone 5, praised a variety called Rubine, R-U-B-I-N-E, for its beautiful red-colored leaves and sprouts, which she explained made the cabbage worms and other green caterpillars easier to see and squish. Now, no matter the variety, the basic trick to growing great BS is to time the plants so that they don't begin setting their little cabbages until cool weather arrives in the fall. If they start to form while it's still hot, you are going to get those small, loose-leafed ones. Now, Brussels sprouts are a long-season crop. It typically takes at least 90 days from transplant of six-week-old starts for the first little cabbages to start forming. That red rubine takes 120 days, and it's not unusual to see varieties with even longer days to maturity. But that's fine, because these plants are the ultimate cold weather lovers. Frost doesn't kill or even remotely bother the plants. And the little cabbages always taste sweetest when they're picked after the weather goes north. Brussels sprout lovers say that the sprouts actually have to sit through freezing cold nights to really taste good. The fact that your starts have already been good-looking and strong shows that you're raising them right. And it sounds like your soil has the natural richness these plants crave. So improving your timing may be all that's necessary here. Time your starts so that they'll hit the days to maturity listed on the seed packet right around the time your average daytime temperatures typically fall to around 65 degrees. These things are just the opposite of tomatoes and peppers. You want the plants to start forming their edibles just as your main crops of summer are winding down. So if, like me, you start your tomatoes and other summer crops in early March for transplanting out in mid to late May, you'd start a Brussels sprout variety that had a 90 days to maturity rating in May, in June, in a warmer climb than your chilly Zone 5, and you transplant them out around the end of June or even early July. This would have them forming their first heads up in late September, which would be close to perfect. Keep the young plants cool in the heat of the summer with liberal watering and a soil-cooling mulch of shredded leaves or straw. Then, when weather starts to chill, look for the sprouts to begin forming down towards the bottom of the plant. The first little cabbages always appear down low and then progress up the plant. These should be bigger and tighter now that they're heading up in cold weather. Pull off the leaves of the plant as you pick to encourage the fast growth of big new sprouts. Don't worry if the first ones you pick are a little small and loose-leafed. Pick them promptly, de-leaf the plant as you go, and they should get tighter and bigger as the harvest progresses up the plant. Don't worry about frost, and then don't worry about hard freezes. The sprouts that form after your first hard freeze should be the best tasting of all, and you should be able to keep picking them through at least December. After that, a lot of people will gently and slowly rock and push the plant until it's almost out of the ground, lay it down on its side, cover it with mulch, and continue harvesting through the winter and early spring. When the weather finally does get hot again, rip that plant out of the ground. It's done. Some gardeners, however, prefer to top their plants to get a big uniform harvest. To do this, wait until the sprouts at the bottom of the plant are half to three-quarters of an inch in diameter, and then break off the growing tip of the stalk. The plant's going to stop growing at that point, and it'll direct all of its energy into producing a final run of big, well-shaped sprouts. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the misunderstood sprout from Brussels now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to feed me sprouts that simmered in the summer if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our archives, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Fred Snyder. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. The tightly wrapped Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda, no relation, McGrath, also flourishes in cold weather. Our editor, Al Banks, looks like his sprouts have loosened up in the summer heat. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, saying please don't top me so I can see you next week. Many people are curious about the cultivars known as currants. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what these fruits need to produce their distinctive berries. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Carrots, cauliflower, clematis, Mike's cantankerous cogitations can help us all come up with compelling gardens. So join Mike for You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 11 here on